Welcome to MedCast, the podcast from MedCAI, the Maryland State Medical Society. Each episode, we'll be doing a deep dive into medicine and taking an insider's view on issues facing Maryland's physicians and patients and healthcare more broadly. I'm your host, Dr. Stephen Rockauer. Today, my guest is Dr. Harry Ashrawat. He is an urologist in Anne Arundel County, and he has been a longtime star in the Maryland Medical Society. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Ashrawat, or I should probably call you Harry because we know you so well. So let's start with a few background things. Tell me about where you grew up, where you went to medical school, your training, and how you came to Maryland.
Thanks, Steve. I was raised and born in the north part of India, in the state of Punjab, and I did my medical school in Glancy Medical School in Amritsar, India. I did my first 2 years of house job in India, and then I emigrated to United States of America and did my general surgery at SUNY at Buffalo, as well as the urology residency there.
And how did you get involved in MedCAI?
I got involved with MedCAI because I was friends with Dr. George Maloof Sr., and he saw me to become the president of the Prince George's County Medical Society. And after I finished my presidency of Prince George's County Medical Society, Dr. Maloof one day called me and he says, we need you at MedCAI. And he immediately made me agree to that. And I joined MedCAI as the secretary of the MedCAI Society.
So now you're a urologist in Prince George's County, and you've been involved with a lot of things around Maryland in terms of medical practice. Tell me about some of the things of the ACOs and the ACA and how that has affected physicians and patients in Maryland.
Good, Steve. That is very close to my heart. When Obamacare was passed in 2010, I took that opportunity because I read the whole act, the Affordable Care Act, and I felt that this can benefit the primary physicians in Prince George's County as well as in state of Maryland. So I visited almost every county in state of Maryland, and my first visit was in Cumberland, and that was the first place I was be able to help them to form an accountable care organization. And they were the first organization who got the incentive money of $1.8 million to help the primary physicians. I felt that that was a very, very good act to provide a very cost-effective care where the primary physicians become the in charge of the orchestra, as we all call. But I think there were some deficiencies in that act, and the deficiency was that did not involve the specialist into the ACO. If the specialist would have been involved, we would have really controlled the cost and given a very high quality of care. During that time, we were also be able to make another ACO on the Eastern Shore. And since that time, there have been a lot of ACOs, which really benefited the primary physicians, but not to the extent if we would have combined the practices of primary physician as the specialist to control the cost. So ACO was my main thing during my presidency, where I spent a lot of time with different presidents of different smaller societies in the state of Maryland. That was really made me very happy that we have given some power to the primary physicians to control the cost and give a very high care, medical care to the patients.
The ACOs have been quite helpful for primary care. And I know that Maryland now has a new primary care EQIP program that is funneling a lot of money into private practices as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that is very true. And this has been going on with the help of MedCAI. I really give a lot of credence to our society that we are always trying to benefit the physicians. MedCAI has been our society for all physicians, but this time for the last 3 years, we are really trying to help the primary physicians to provide a good medical care to our patients in the state of Maryland.
You talk about the problems in the last 3 years with the COVID crisis and pandemic, we've all had to switch to figuring out how to do telemedicine. How has your practice done that?
Very interesting. I think personally, I feel this has benefited patients the most and their families. For my own self, you know, I have very old patients in urology who come to see me, either somebody, their daughter or wives, they have to bring the patients. And it was difficult, either they have to hire somebody. But once the telemedicine was approved, they were so happy that their sons and daughters always used to say, oh, this is the best thing happened. We don't have to take half a day off or a full day off to do this, because they could easily go to their house and, you know, be able to talk to their primary physician or the specialist. So this was very beneficial. I remember prior to the pandemic, only 6% of our visits were telemedicine. But once we started doing during the pandemic, it went more than 65%. And it did benefit them. We could talk to them and continue to provide that care, which was beneficial to the patients. No doubt it was a little bit financially not very good for the physicians, but I think in long run, this has become a very good a tool for us to be able to communicate to our patients who are elderly and cannot come to the office. So I feel pandemic did help patients as well as physicians, but I always feel thankful to the government, who also provided some incentive money to continue to do this and be able to survive this pandemic, because financially it could have been a disaster.
Yes, I know that telemedicine presented an awful lot of challenges, especially in orthopedics, being able to actually examine people. I can imagine in urology, that was a significant problem as well. How did you get around that?
You're very right. I think, in yours is, as far as orthopedics is concerned, it has to be seen. It is more of an urgent situation. Whenever we see our patients, whether doing a rectal exam or doing a PSA, it can all be delayed. We will delay the follow-up visit for 4 to 6 months. It was not going to have a detrimental effect on the health of the patient. There are cases where we felt they have delayed in the treatment of patients where the cancers of the bladder, urinary bladder, kidney, as well as sometimes prostate. But these were the things we were able to do and try to go and see the patient at least after 6 months in the office, taking care of all whatever we were need to, you know, wash our hands, distance, masking ourselves. We were able to see, but it did not affect the real health of the patient. There was a delay in the treatment, but still it was done one way or the other. And I can understand the specialty where physical examination and examining a patient like orthopedics did suffer. And it has also affect financially to those physicians who are in orthopedics.
Sure, but you were able, it's good that you were still able to at least get certain patients into the office, again, with all the proper PPE and barriers to keep everybody healthy, not only for yourself, the patient, your office staff, and their family.
Yeah, I think, Steve, the good thing was that only one person, one physician will be there and could who needs physical examination, he could examine all the patients for all other 7-8 urologists. So it was sort of not a full office, but it was very discreet that people were waiting outside. So they were not coming in the office. They were called with the telephone to come in. When the doctor was ready, all things were cleaned with Clorox and everything, and using all the PPE, as you said. And that's why we were following the rules not to hurt the patient or the physician or the staff.
Terrific. But as you said, with delays in care, sometimes there were some problems, things that maybe got out of hand. What was the liability that was brought up, and how were you able to get around some of that?
Steve, as you know, that this was an emergency declared by the country as well as the state. So during those times, the legal issues sort of becomes not big issues, because you really could not sue anybody. But it did hurt people where there is a delay of system or people kept on bleeding. because you also could not even schedule patients in the hospital. See, that was the biggest thing. The delay was not that we didn't want to go and take that chance to help the patient. Most majority of the time, the problem was at the hospital, I could do only one case, and then I have to wait half an hour to 45 minutes to get to another case. So to do two cases, I have to be there for 4 to 5 hours in the hospital, and you could do only two cases, where my average cases ran from 5 to 6 a week, or maybe 7. But that was the problem we were facing, no doubt. The doctors did excellent job by taking the chance to help the patients who really was in need, especially the bleeding patients or people who were in retention or people who have stone, and it was in a need for something to be done to temporize the thing and relieve their pain. So definitely there has been delay. People have not been treated the way we usually treat, and the urgency was there, but it has to be delayed.
And that obviously was a system problem, not only between the physicians and the patients, but also the hospitals, the EMTs, and everybody that gets involved in medical care. We were trying to figure it out as we went, trying to do the best for the patients within the limits of what we were able to do, trying to figure out this completely new disease that was going around.
I agree with you, Steve. What doctors have done and what the medical staff has done is I salute to them. People died taking care of the patient, but they didn't retract. They moved forward to help them. I really feel that the medical profession has done a tremendous job during this pandemic to take care of people. And many of our physicians died during that. Or some people, as you know, there is an act for Dr. Breen, who committed suicide after being in the hospital for so long, and it was detrimental to families. Their nurses staying there for 36 hours, couldn't go home, go to another house. They didn't want to infect their children and spouses at home. So it was a big sacrifice. And I think our medical, staff as well as physicians and PAs, nurses, they stood up. They stood up and helped the community and the country in a big way. And I'm always thank them and my salute to them.
Yes, the everybody in and around the hospital really stepped up. Not only the nursing staff, but the janitorial staff. As I said, the EMTs. Everybody in and around really stepped up to help out. Funding for this podcast has been made possible by the Medical Mutual Liability Insurance Company of Maryland. Since 1975, they've been dedicated to providing the most aggressive defense of practices and reputations while providing affordable and comprehensive coverage. Get the insurance coverages you need to keep your medical practice safe. Visit www.mmlis.com for details. Funding for this broadcast has been made possible by iPrescribe. Toss your prescription pad. Now there's a safe and easy way to prescribe any drug from your smartphone while you're away from the office. The app also includes access to your patient's medical history, state PDMP, clinical alerts, and more. Visit iPrescribe.com to learn more. Welcome back to MedCast, the podcast from MedKai, the Maryland State Medical Society. If you're just joining us, we're continuing our discussion with Dr. Harry Ajarwat as he discusses his life in urology and the problems facing physicians in medicine. With the medical emergency that was declared, many PAs and nurses got additional capabilities and authority to do various types of medical procedures and evaluations. Now that that's closed, where do you think that scope problems will head in the future?
Steve, very, very important question. I think our ultimate goal is to provide the best care to our patients. So when we create all these certification licenses to be done, I think there is some basic understanding that you are qualified to be certified to do these things. So my concern is always that whenever the advanced provider, practice providers are there, everything is under supervision, whosoever you are. I think if we allow this to go out, we will have no control. And it is our job, this is our profession, to provide the best care. See, I always define the profession. Sometimes people ask me, are you a business? I says, we are not a business, because we are a profession. And a professional is the one who made a voluntary contract with the society that they are, we are going to keep you healthy based on one thing, and that is called trust. How did the public develop a trust? Because we have had full training. We have gone through all the training which is required of you. And then you have been certified. Not everybody can sit and open, put a shingle there and become a doctor, as many of the now people who are not trained to be physician want to be called physician. It is bothersome. I do understand we have shortage of physicians, but I think the as adjunct to our service giving to public, they can be there, but I think they need to be supervised. I am pretty strong about that, that one should be supervised. And once you have appropriate training, then I think there should be a ways for them to get the appropriate treatment and then move forward from there. But supervising powers of physicians should always be there. That is personally, I believe. And this is for the sake of my patients, so they don't get hurt.
Oh, I agree completely. It's always a problem when the things that get you into trouble is not what you don't know, it's what you think you know, but you really don't. So as long as we're talking about medical service, let's talk about some of the underserved people, such as the people from Medicaid. I understand something new happened in the legislature this session.
Yeah, Steve, that was a very big win. That was win for the patients, win for the physicians. And this was the payment for Medicaid services, especially the E&M codes. As you know, we started this in 2010 and 11. And in 12, O'Malley, when he came and he started paying E&M codes for Medicaid patient and parity with what we get from Medicare E&M codes. It started with 100%, but after 4 to 6 years, it came down to 92 cents on a dollar. And again, this year, the budget has been approved. We will be paid for E&M codes in parity with that of Medicare. What that does is that it also provides the Medicaid patients the services of specialists who start seeing them because they are being reimbursed just to carry their business, the regular business. They may not be paid for the as good as Medicare pays for any procedures and surgeries, but they at least can be seen. And as you know, when you are a Medicaid population, this is a younger population, and they don't happen to see the physicians very often, and the surgical procedures are usually between 3 to 7% only. So it is sort of a service by the physicians to the community that we do care. People don't have a very good insurance, but by incentivizing that they are getting something to examine the patient and to see them and give their opinion, I think this was a very good win for MedKai. And MedKai needs to be applauded for that. And that is why MedKai, I feel, is so important for organized medicine. And that is why I feel very good that this was a very good win in the legislation this year for patients as well as physicians.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. I believe that when the fees being paid for E&M services are comparable to Medicare, there will be more physicians willing to sign on into the program and be able to see more patients. You know, you've heard me say many times that when I was practicing in Montgomery County, I would have people coming down from Frederick and even further north because nobody between there and Rockville were willing to take the amount of money that was being paid. And now that it's up at 100%, I believe that there will be more people, more physicians signing onto the program so more patients can be taken care of.
Sure. Same thing happened, Steve, to me. I used to get patients in Greenbelt from Gaithersburg and Germantown. because there were urologists who will not take Medicaid. And my name was on, and I wrote that I take new patients, but I had to sort of restrict the number. Each day I could get two new Medicaid patients, and that kept my other schedule going. I could not say that anytime they could come, but every day in my office, two patients could come who were new Medicaid patients. So I was getting patients from all over the place, like you were getting from there. But I think that is our, I think physicians, we feel, do feel for our patients, whosoever they are, whether they are paying or non-paying.
Absolutely. And that brings me to another thing that's been talked about in medicine recently is what they call the Surprise Billing Act, where physicians are supposedly billing patients much higher rates than they would otherwise get paid. Is that really a good phrase to use, or the insurance companies have something to do with that?
Yeah, as you know, Steve, surprise bills were, you know, and now we have a Surprise Act, as this was when people will get bills from the hospital, from different specialists and everything. And there was, it was hurting patients. They were losing their houses, getting mortgages and this and that. And that was not a very good thing. So AMA and MedCAI were pretty instrumental helping this to be done. But at this time, as you know, the Surprise Act is more lopsided towards the insurers because they are not still, they are benefiting by not paying appropriate amount of money. But Steve, as you know, in state of Maryland, and MedCAI introduced a bill and got it through in 2009 and 10, because we felt the need of these people who were non-par with insurance companies that they should be paid. So the bill was passed, and what we agreed to, that they will be paid at about 140% of Medicare payment for the same procedure. And it was very well received by the physicians who were covering the emergency, and they were non-par with anything. So MedCAI has led us to, as they are visionaries, the physicians in MedCAI, I really salute to them, are visionaries. We did this almost 10, 11 years ago or 12 years ago, what is being done now. And I think this is a good act, but there are lawsuits against the, what is the independent review committee, whatever they have decided. It is not fair to the physicians. So I think it is being challenged, and I think we need to make some changes. And AMA, MedCAI will continue to work on that when this thing will be more favorable, or it should be favorable to both sides, but I would like to be more favorable towards the physicians of state of Maryland so they get appropriate payments for providing the services to the patient.
Right, and the important thing is keeping the patients out of the financial straits that the insurance companies think they're in. If it's only a negotiation between physicians and insurance companies about what the proper payment is, and it doesn't get passed on to the patient, that's the appropriate way to do it.
Yeah, I agree with you, Steve. The only good thing in this is when patient doesn't have to worry about paying bills or what is going to come, they tend to follow up your appointments. They are not worried about it, but they make arrangements. So it is beneficial to keep people healthy, to have a proper follow-up. And this is what I feel is the right thing, that they have this Surprise Act. I think it needs to be amended or modified, and I think it will be done. I think we have approached several of the congressmen, and through the AACU, I've already talked to two or three congressmen regarding that, and I think it will be addressed.
I think that's wonderful. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and do a few things non-medical.
Sure.
what would you be doing if you were not a physician?
Very interesting. Thanks, Steve, asking. I just have to tell you my background, that I am from a family of doctors. There are more than 30 doctors in my family. So all my life in the beginning, I always wanted to be a surgeon because my father was a surgeon who developed the specialty of anesthesiology in North India and is also known as father of anesthesia in that part of the country. But if the question is very good, but what I would like to, or I would have done if I was not physician, will be farming. And my reason was to help the poor and the needy and the hungry. we had a very big farm, and I felt that this was only about 5% chance. If I would have been not a physician, I would have been a farmer, producing a lot of, bringing a green and white revolution in India, providing a lot of stuff, you know, revolution in India for the dairy products, the, providing the grain and everything. But it was quite a bit during my time with the help of America. In fact, in my state, there was a very large dairy farm was started, and they provided milk, everything pasteurized properly to the whole of the state. So that will be thing I would have loved to do, was to be an agriculturist, but not a small one, but at a very big scale.
Okay, so you never had a choice not to be a physician.
I always wanted to be a surgeon. So this is the choice I was, even when I was interested after my medical school, what kind of specialty want to do. They had three choices, and I said surgery, surgery, and surgery. because I was on the topper in the class, they usually, all people at the top usually go to internal medicine. And I was the first one in many years that who asked for surgery and not to be an internal medicine.
What type of reading or listening do you like to do?
Steve, nowadays, I to tell you the truth, I am watching YouTube. That is what I am. I love history. So all kind of history I am going through. In fact, World War II, World War I, the Mughal Empire in India. And it's very intriguing for me, and it is very easy. Usually these YouTubes have synopsis of World War II, World War I. And that is my latest, but I have gone through multiple, the history of Taj Mahal was another thing during the Mughal times in India. So a lot of the saints and sages, because my inclination towards spirituality, I am going through, and it is really intriguing me that how beautiful the world is if you weigh the way these people think.
If you could change one thing in the world, what would it be?
Very interesting. I'm going to sort of take a little bit of view. I always think about who am I, and when I see that, this is a question I got in 1985 when I asked who am I, it was a flash of that I am a perfect being. So when I really went deep into it, and I realized that everybody else is perfect. So the very purpose of life became that you only maintain what you have and that you are the best. But the mission of my life became that I will like to let other perfections know they are the best born, because they are so unique and they can never be created. So during that time, I came to understanding of spiritual thought, what spirituality was. And in that, spirituality was a conscious thought, which is beneficial to every living being and its environment. Once I start doing that, and I says, how come it is not happening? That is how in spirituality aspect is that there are seekers which will ongoing, and they seek for rest of their life and they continue to live well. When the believers, when people say, I am a believer, because they put an end to that seeking part of exploring yourself and exploring the universe. So that is what, if I ever would like to change that, if I can change that thought process from a believer to a seeker.
That's interesting. And on that type of theme, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Yeah, that is very interesting. And I thought about it. And at times, what I would have done if I was a younger self, I think I will continue to do hard work, but I will like to do it smartly. Being so intelligent, you can be very hard work, but the being a conscious thought, you should also be very smart. I feel that. And number two, I feel is that I will like to be a better listener, because nobody has ever learned by talking. But that is something We used to talk as a younger person, and I like to be bigger listener. I think the if you listen well, I think you are a better leader.
I think that's a wonderful way to end. So thank you to Dr. Harry Ajarwat, who's been our guest here on MedCast, the podcast from MedChi, the Maryland State Medical Society. Tune in next time as we continue our conversation with the leaders of medicine in Maryland to discuss the issues facing our patients and physicians. For all of us here at MedChi, I'm Dr. Stephen Rockauer. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.